crabs and other eels, whitefish, char, shark, herring, mackerel, and cod. Crabs and lobsters, some of truly monstrous size, are found everywhere along its shores, while seals, narwhals, walruses, and sea lions have their rookeries and breeding grounds on and around the countless rocky islands and sea stacks. Ice dragons notwithstanding, the true kings of these northern waters are the whales. Half a dozen types of these great beasts make their homes in the shivering sea. Amongst them, grey whales, white whales, humpbacks, savage spotted whales with their hunting packs, which many call the wolves of the wild sea, and the mighty leviathans, the oldest and largest of all the living creatures of the earth. The westernmost reaches of the shivering sea, from Skagos and the grey cliffs to the delta of the Sound, are the richest fishing grounds in the known world. Cod and herring are especially abundant here. Fisherfolk from lands as distant as the Three Sisters in the west and Morash in the east have been known to work these waters. But they do so at the sufferance of the free city of Braavos, whose fleets dominate the seas northwest of Essos, protected by their sea lords' warships. Together with banking and trade, fishing is one of the three pillars upon which the wealth and prosperity of Braavos is founded. Sailing eastward, an intrepid seafarer will eventually pass from Braavosi waters to those where the free city of Loreth holds sway, albeit with a feebler grip, and thence pass the Axe, where many different peoples have lived and died and perished over the millennia in wars beyond count. East of the Axe are the deep blue waters of Bitterweed Bay, where ships from Ib and Loreth have so often contested for supremacy, and the last great war fleet of the Kingdom of Zanor was sent to the bottom by the Sea Lord of Braavos. On Ib these waters are known as Battle Bay, whilst the Lerathi name them Bloody Bay. By any name, 1,000 sunken ships and the bones of 50,000 drowned sailors are said to be strewn across the bay's bottom, home to the crabs for which Bitterweed is renowned. Beyond Bitterweed Bay lies the delta of the Sarn, the great north-flowing river whose many vassal streams drain much of central Essos. Here stands Sarth, with its white walls, the last, and least, many say, of the great cities of the fallen kingdom of Sarnor. The ruins of Sarth's sister city, Sarus, sacked and destroyed by a Dothraki Khal centuries ago, can be found across the width of the delta. Between them, at another mouth of the great river, rises the Lerathi mining and fishing colony, Morash. Those bold enough to continue still farther east will next pass the shores of the small pastoral kingdom of Umber, whose craven kings and feeble princes are best known for the grain, gems, and girls they pay the Dothraki horse lords each year to be left unmolested. East of Umber, our sailor will reach the Bay of Tusks, famed as the breeding grounds of walrus, and soon thereafter the intrepid seafarer will find himself crossing the heart of the shivering sea, where every rock and wave is ruled by the hairy men from the great island of Ib. Ib. Through the centuries, many different peoples have made their homes upon the shores and islands of the shivering sea and sent their mariners across its chilly, grey-green waters. The most enduring and significant of these are the Ibanese, an ancient and taciturn race of islanders who have fished the northern seas since the dawn of days from their homes upon the Ibish Isles. The Ebony stand apart from the other races of mankind. They are a heavy people, broad about the chest and shoulders, but seldom standing more than 5.5 feet in height, with thick, short legs and long arms. Though short and squat, they are ferociously strong. At wrestling, their favorite sport, no man of the Seven Kingdoms can hope to equal them. Their faces, characterized by sloping brows, with heavy ridges, small sunken eyes, great square teeth, and massive jaws, seem brutish and ugly to Westerosi eyes, an impression heightened by their guttural, grunting tongue. But in truth, the men of Ib are a cunning folk, skilled craftsmen, able hunters and trackers, and doughty warriors. They are the most hirsute people in the known world, though their flesh is pale, with dark blue veins beneath the skin. Their hair is dark and wiry. Ebony's men are heavily bearded. Wiry body hair covers their arms, legs, chests, and backs. Coarse dark hair is common amongst their women, even on the upper lip. The persistent myth that Ebony's females have 6 breasts has no truth to it, however. Though the men of Ib can father children upon the women of Westeros and other lands, the products of such unions are often malformed and inevitably sterile, in the manner of mules. Ebony's females, when mated with men from other races, bring forth naught but stillbirths and monstrosities. Such matings are uncommon. Those ships from the port of Ibn are a common sight in harbours up and down the narrow sea, and even as far away as the Summer Isles and Old Volantis. The sailors who crew them keep to their own kind, even when ashore, and display a deep suspicion of all strangers. On Ib itself, men of other lands and races are restricted by law and custom to the harbour precincts of the port of Ibn, and forbidden to venture beyond the city save in the company of an Ebonese host. Such invitations are exceedingly rare.
The history of the fighting pits of Meereen, known as the Red Book, written by an unknown Yunkish hand and translated centuries after by Maester Elkin, makes passing reference to the fact that many of the Ebonese women sold into slavery ended their days in the fighting pits of Meereen, Yunkai, and Astapor, for the slavers of the south deemed them too ugly to serve as bed-slaves and too savage to use as field-hands.
Ib is the second largest island in the known world. Only Great Morrick, between the Jade and Summer Seas, is larger. Stony and mountainous, Ib is a land of great grey mountains, ancient forests, and rushing rivers, its dark interior a haunt of bears and wolves. Giants once dwelt on Ib, we are told, but none remain. Though mammoths still roam the island's plains and hills, and in the higher mountains some claim unicorns can be found. The Ebonese of the woods and mountains have even less love of strangers than their cousins by the sea, and seldom speak any tongue but their own. Foresters, goat-herds, and miners, they make their homes in caves or houses of grey stone, dug into the earth, and roofed with slate or thatch. Towns and villages are rare. The Ebonese of the interior prefer to dwell apart from their fellows, in solitary compounds, gathering only for weddings, burials, and worship. Gold, iron, and tin can be found in abundance in the mountains of Ib, as well as timber, amber, and 100 sorts of pelts in the island's forests. The Ebonese of the shore are more venturesome folk than their cousins from the woods and mountains. Bold fishermen, they travel the northern seas widely in search of cod, herring, whitefish, and eel. But it is as whalers that they are best known in the wider world. Their great bellied whaling ships are a common sight in ports up and down the narrow sea and beyond. Though seldom pleasing to the eye or nose, Ebony's ships are renowned for their strength, for they are built to weather any storm and withstand the assaults of even the largest leviathans. The bone, blubber, and oil of the whales they hunt are Ib's chief stock and trade, and have made the port of Ibn the largest and richest city of the Shivering Sea. Grey and gloomy, the port of Ibn has ruled over Ib and the Lesser Isle since the dawn of days. A city of cobbled alleys, steep hills, and teeming docks and shipyards, lit by hundreds of whale oil lamps suspended over its streets on iron chains, the port is dominated by the ruins of the God King's Castle, a colossal structure of rough-hewn stone that was home to 100 Ebony's kings. The last such king was thrown down in the aftermath of the doom of Valeria, however. Today Ib and the Lesser Isles are governed by the Shadow Council, whose members are chosen by the Thousand, an assembly of wealthy guildsmen, ancient nobles, priests, and priestesses, not unlike the Magister's councils of the Free Cities. Far Ib, second largest of the Ebony's Islands, lies more than 100 leagues southeast of Ib itself, and is altogether a bleaker and poorer place. Ibsar, its only town, was originally a place of exile and punishment, where the Ebony's of old sent their most notorious criminals, often after mutilating them so they might never return to Ib itself. Though that practice ended with the fall of the God Kings, Ibsar retains an unsavory reputation to this very day. The men of Ib have not always confined themselves to their islands. There is abundant evidence of Ebony's settlements on the Axe, on the Larathi Isles, and along the shores of the Bitterweed Bay and the Bay of Tusks in the west, and Leviathan Sound and the Thousand Islands in the east. And history tells of several Ebony's attempts to seize control of the mouth of the San, attempts that brought the hairy men into bloody conflict with the Sonori sister cities, Sarth and Sarus. The God Kings of Ib, before their fall, did succeed in conquering and colonizing a huge swathe of northern Essos, immediately south of Ib itself, a densely wooded region that had formerly been the home of a small, shy forest folk. Some say that the Ebony's extinguished this gentle race, while others believe they went into hiding in the deeper woods or fled to other lands. The Dothraki still call the great forests along the northern coast the kingdom of the Efikevron, the name by which they knew the vanished forest dwellers. The fabled sea snake, Corlys Velaryon, lord of the tides, was the first Westerosi to visit these woods. After his return from the Thousand Islands, he wrote of carved trees, haunted grottos, and strange silences. A later traveller, the merchant adventurer Brian of Oldtown, captain of the cog Spearshaker, provided an account of his own journey across the Shivering Sea. He reported that the Dothraki name for the lost people meant those who walk in the woods. None of the Ebony's that Brian of Oldtown met could say that they had ever seen a woods walker, but claimed that the little people blessed a household that left offerings of leaf and stone and water overnight. At its greatest extent, the Ebony's foothold in Essos was as large as Ib itself, and far richer. More and more of the hairy men crossed over from the islands to make their fortunes there, cutting down the trees to put the land under the plough, damming the rivers and streams, mining the hills. Ruling over these domains was Ibish, a fishing village that swelled to become a thriving port and the second city of the Ebony's, with a deep harbour and high white walls. All that ended 200 years ago with the coming of the Dothraki. The horse lords had hitherto shunned the forests of the northern coast. Some say this was because of their reverence for the vanished woodwalkers, others because they feared their powers. Whatever the truth, the Dothraki did not fear the men of Ib. Carl after Carl began to make incursions into Ibbani's territories, overrunning the farms and fields and holdfasts of the hairy men with fire and steel, putting the males to the sword whilst carrying off their wives into slavery. The Ibbanese are notoriously avaricious and, yea, even niggardly people, refused to pay the tribute the Carls demanded, choosing to fight instead. Though the men of Ib won several notable victories, famously destroying the huge khalasar of the fearsome Carl Unko in one epic battle, the Dothraki only came in greater numbers, as each new Carl sought to eclipse the conquests of the last. The khalasars pushed the Ibbanese farther and farther back, until at last they overwhelmed even the great city of Ibish. Carl Skorro was the first to take the city, breaking through the whalebone gates to loot the temples and treasuries and carry off the city's guards to Vaes Dothrak. The Ibbanese rebuilt, but a generation later, Ibish was sacked again by Carl Rogo, who put half the city to the torch and marched 10,000 women to slavery. Today only ruins remain where Ibish once stood, a place the Dothraki name Vaes Arasak, or City of Cowards. For when the khalasar of Onko's grandson, Carl Dako, approached to sack the city once again, the remaining inhabitants took to their ships and fled back across the sea to Ib. In his wrath, Dako not only put the abandoned city to the torch, but burned so much of the surrounding countryside that he was thereafter known as the Dragon of the North. Ib retains a modest foothold on Essos even to this day, on a small peninsula surrounded by the sea and defended by a wooden wall almost as long as the ice wall of the Night's Watch, if not a third as high, a towering earth and timber palisade bristling with defensive towers and protected by a deep ditch. Behind the earthworks, the men of Ib have built the town of New Ibish to rule over their much diminished domains. But sailors say that the new town is a sad and squalid place, more akin to Ibsar than to the thriving city that the horse lords reduced to ruins.
Terio Erastes, the great Bravossi adventurer, kept a record of his time among the Dothraki and witnessed the fall of Ibish while a guest of Carl Dako. His chronicle, Fire Upon the Grass, notes that Carl Dako was said to take great pride in being accounted the Dragon of the North, but at the end he came to rue it. For when his khalasar was broken in battle by that of Carl Temo, the younger Carl took the elder captive and fed him to the flames, cutting off his hands and feet and genitals and roasting them before his eyes, after first burning his wives and sons in the same manner.
East of Ib. Beyond the Ibish coastlands and forests of the Ifakevron, the foothills of the Bones rise up out of the grasslands, and farther east the mountains themselves march down to meet the sea. Even from miles out into the shivering sea, the great northern peaks, with their icy crowns and jagged spires, seem to split the very sky. Krashar Zaska, the Dothraki call the northernmost of the Bones, the White Mountains. Beyond them lies another world, one that very few of Westerosi have ever visited. Those who have come this far, like Lomas Lungstrider, have come by land through the mountain passes, or by the way of the warm southern waters and the Jade Gates. Though the eastern waters of the Shivering Sea are as rich as those of the west, few come to fish them, save the Ibanis themselves. For beyond the bones are found the lands of the nomadic Jugus-Nahai, a savage race of mounted warriors with no ships and no interest in the sea. Whalers from the port of Iban regularly hunt Leviathan Sound, where those great beasts come to mate and birth their young, and Ibanese fishermen speak of vast schools of cod in the deeper waters, seals and walrus on the rocky islands to the north, and spider crabs and emperor crabs everywhere, but elsewise these eastern seas are empty. Still farther east lie the so-called Thousand Islands. Ibanese chartmakers tell us that there are in truth fewer than 300. A sea-girt scatter of bleak, windswept rocks, believed by some to be the last remnants of a drowned kingdom, whose towns and towers were submerged beneath the rising seas many thousands of years ago. Only the boldest or the most desperate mariners ever make landfall here. For the people of these islands, though few in number, are a queer folk, inimical to strangers, a hairless people with green-tinged skin, who file the teeth of their females into sharp points and slice the foreskins from the members of their males. They speak no known tongue, and are said to sacrifice sailors to their squamous, fish-headed gods, likenesses of whom rise from their stony shores, visible only when the tide recedes. Though surrounded by water on all sides, these islanders fear the sea so much that they will not set foot in the water, even under threat of death. Even Corlys Velaryon did sail no farther east than the Thousand Islands. This was where the sea snake turned back on his great northern voyage. In truth, there was no reason for him to continue, save for his hunger to learn what lay beyond the next horizon. Even the fish taken from these eastern seas are oddly misshapen, with a bitter, unpleasant taste, it is said. Only one port of note is to be found on the Shivering Sea, east of the Bones. Nefer, chief city of the kingdom of Nogai, hemmed in by towering chalk cliffs and perpetually shrouded in fog. When seen from the harbour, Nefer appears to be no more than a small town, but it is said that 9/10 of the city is beneath the ground. For that reason, travellers call Nefer the secret city. By any name, the city enjoys a sinister reputation as a haunt of necromancers and torturers. Beyond Nogai are the forests of Mussavi, a cold, dark land of shape-changers and demon-hunters. Beyond Mussavi, no man of Westeros can truly say. Certain septons have claimed that the world ends east of Mussavi, giving way to a realm of mists, then a realm of darkness, and finally a realm of storm and chaos where sea and sky become as one. Sailors and singers and other dreamers prefer to believe that the Shivering Sea goes on and on unending, past the easternmost coasts of Essos, past islands and continents unknown, uncharted, and undreamed of, where strange peoples worship strange gods beneath stranger stars. Wiser men suggest that somewhere beyond the waters we know, east becomes west, and the Shivering Sea must surely join the Sunset Sea, if indeed the world is round. It may be so, or not, until some new sea snake arises to sail beyond the sunrise, no man can know for certain. The Bones and Beyond. East beyond Vaes Dothrak and the Mother of Mountains, the grasslands give way to rolling plains and woods, and the earth beneath the traveller's feet turns hard and stony, and begins to climb upward, ever upward. The hills grow wilder and steeper, and soon enough the mountains appear in the far distance, their great peaks seeming to float against the eastern sky. Blue-grey giants so huge and jagged and menacing that even Lomas Longstrider, that dauntless wanderer, if his tales be true, lost heart at the sight of them, believing that he had at last reached the ends of the earth. The ancestors of the Dothraki and the other horse peoples of the grasslands knew better, for some remembered crossing those mountains from the lands that lay beyond. Did they come west in hopes of fairer fields and plenty, or in search of conquest, or were they fleeing before some savage foe? Their tales do not agree, so we may never know. But of their travails we may be certain, for they left their bones behind to mark their passing. The bones of men, the bones of horses, the bones of giants and camels and oxen, of every sort of beast and bird and monster, all can be found amongst these savage peaks. From them the mountains take their name, the bones. Tallest of all the mountain ranges in the known world, from the sunset sea to Ashai by the shadow, the bones extend from the shivering sea to the Jade Sea, a wall of twisted rock and sharp stone, stretching for more than 500 leagues from north to south, and 100 leagues from east to west. Deep snows crown the northern bones, while sandstorms offscour the peaks and valleys of their southern sisters, carving them into strange shapes. In the long leagues between, thundering rivers roar through deep canyons, and small caves open onto vast caverns and sunless seas. Yet however inimical the bones might seem to those who do not know them, they have been home to men and stranger things over the centuries. Even the snow-capped northernmost peaks, known as Krasaj Zaska, or White Mountains in the Dothraki tongue, where the cold winds come howling off the shivering sea winter and summer, were once home to the Jogwin, the stone giants, massive creatures said to have been twice as large as the giants of Westeros. Alas, the last of the Jogwin disappeared 1,000 years ago. Only their massive bones remain to mark where they once roamed. 1,000 roads lead into the bones. Wise men say from Kaas to Kohor, but only 3 lead out. As impassable as the bones appear from afar, there are indeed hundreds of footpaths, goat tracks, game trails, stream beds, and slopes by which travellers, traders, and adventurers may find their way into the heart of the mountains. In certain places, ancient carved steps and hidden tunnels and passages exist for those who know how to find them. Yet many of these paths are treacherous, and others are dead ends or traps for the unwary. Small parties, well armed and well provisioned, may make their way through the bones by myriad ways, when led by a guide who knows the dangers. Armies, trading caravans, and men alone, however, are well advised to stay to the main routes, the 3 great mountain passes that bridge the worlds of east and west, the Steel Road, the Stone Road, and the Sand Road. The Steel Road, so named for all the battles it has seen, and the Stone Road both originate in Vaes Dothrak, the former running almost due east beneath the highest peaks, the latter curving southeast to join the old Silk Road at the ruins of Yinishar, called Vaes Jinni by the Horse Lords, before beginning its climb. Far south of these, the Sand Road passes through the southern bones, sometimes called the Dry Bones, for water is scarce there. and surrounding deserts connecting the great port city of Karth with the market city Tiqui, the gateway to the east. Even along these well-traveled routes, crossing the bones remains grueling and hazardous, and safe passage comes at a price. For on the far side of the mountains stand three mighty fortress cities, last remnants of the once great patrimony of Herkun. Bayasabad, the city of serpents, guards the eastern end of the sand road and exacts tribute from all those who seek to pass. The stone road, with its deep defiles and endless narrow switchbacks, passes beneath the walls of Samiriana, a grey stone city carved into the very rock of the mountains it defends. In the north, fur-clad warriors ride the steel road over swaying bridges and through underground passageways, escorting caravans to and from Kaya Kaya Naya, whose walls are black basalt, black iron, and yellow bone.
Many accounts inform us that the mountain warriors of Kaya Kaya Naya, Samiriana, and Bayasabad are all women, daughters of the great fathers who rule these cities, where girls learn to ride and climb before they learn to walk, and are schooled in the arts of the bow, the spear, the knife, and the sling from earliest childhood. Lomas Longstrider himself tells us that there are no fiercer fighters on all the earth. As for their brothers, the sons of the great fathers, 99 of every 100 are gelded when they reach the age of manhood, and live out their lives as eunuchs, serving their cities as scribes, priests, scholars, servants, cooks, farmers, and craftsmen. Only the most promising males, the largest and strongest and most comely, are permitted to mature and breed and become great fathers themselves in their turns. Maester Nalin's Rubies and Iron, named for the penchant of the warrior women to wear iron rings in their nipples and rubies in their cheeks, speculates on the circumstances that led to such strange customs.
The three fortress cities began as true forts, outposts, and garrisons raised up by the patriarchs of Herkun to guard the western marches of their realm against the brigands, outlaws, and wild men of the bones, and the savages who dwelt beyond them. Over the centuries, however, the citadels grew into cities, while Herkun herself withered into dust, as its lakes and rivers dried away, and its once fertile fields turned to desert. Today the heartland of Herkun is the Great Sand Sea, a vast wasteland of restless dunes, dry riverbeds, and ruined forts and towns baking beneath the sun. Water is said to boil away. It is so hot in the deep southern portions of the sea. Beyond the Great Sand Sea, another world awaits. The further east, a vast land of plains and hills and river valleys that seem to have no end, where strange gods rule over stranger peoples. Many great cities and proud kingdoms have risen and flourished and fallen here since the dawn of days. Most of these are little known in the West, even their very names long forgotten. Only the broadest outlines of the histories of the further east are known to the citadel, and even in those tales that have come west to us, over long leagues of mountains and deserts, there are many omissions, gaps, and contradictions, making it all but impossible to say with any certainty what portion is true and what portion has arisen from the fevered imaginings of singers, storytellers, and wet nurses. Yet the oldest and greatest of the Eastern civilizations endures to our present day. The ancient, glorious, golden empire of Yi Ti. Yi Ti. A fable land even in the Seven Kingdoms Yiti is a large and diverse country, a realm of windswept plains and rolling hills, jungles and rainforests, deep lakes and rushing rivers, and shrinking inland seas. Its legendary wealth is such as to allow its princes to live in houses of solid gold and dine on sweetmeats powdered with pearls and jade. Lomas Lungstrider, awestruck by its marvels, called Yiti the land of 1,000 gods and 100 princes ruled by one god emperor. Those who have visited Yiti, as it is today, tell us that the 1,000 gods and 100 princes yet remain. But there are 3 god emperors, each claiming the right to don the gowns of cloth of gold, green pearls, and jade that tradition allows to the emperor alone. None wields true power, though millions may worship the azure emperor in Yin and prostrate themselves before him whenever he appears. His imperial writ extends no farther than the walls of his own city. The 100 princes of whom Lomas Lungstrider wrote rule their own realms as they please, as do the brigands, priests, kings, sorcerers, warlords, and imperial generals and tax collectors outside their domains. This was not always so, we know. In ancient days, the god emperors of Yiti were as powerful as any ruler on earth, with wealth that exceeded even that of Valeria at its height, and armies of almost unimaginable size. In the beginning, the priestly scribes of Yin declare, all the lands between the bones and the freezing desert called the Grey Waste, from the Shivering Sea to the Jade Sea, including even the great and holy Isle of Leng, formed a single realm, ruled by the God on Earth, the only begotten son of the Lion of Night, and Maiden Maid of Light, who travel about his domains, in a palanquin carved from a single pearl and carried by 100 queens, his wives. For 10,000 years the great empire of the Dawn flourished in peace and plenty under the God on Earth, until at last he ascended to the stars to join his forebears. Dominion over mankind then passed to his elder son, who was known as the Pearl Emperor, and ruled for 1,000 years. The Jade Emperor, the Tourmaline Emperor, the Onyx Emperor, the Topaz Emperor, and the Opal Emperor followed in turn, each reigning for centuries. Yet every reign was shorter and more troubled than the one preceding it. For wild men and baleful beasts pressed at the borders of the great empire. Lesser kings grew prideful and rebellious, and the common people gave themselves over to avarice, envy, lust, murder, incest, gluttony, and sloth. When the daughter of the Opal Emperor succeeded him as the Amethyst Empress, her envious younger brother cast her down and slew her, proclaiming himself the Bloodstone Emperor and beginning a reign of terror. He practiced dark arts, torture, and necromancy, enslaved his people, took a tiger woman for his bride, feasted on human flesh, and cast down the true gods to worship a black stone that had fallen from the sky. Many scholars count the Bloodstone Emperor as the first high priest of the sinister Church of Starry Wisdom, which persists to this day in many port cities throughout the known world. In the annals of the Further East, it was the Blood Betrayal, as his usurpation is named, that ushered in the Age of Darkness, called the Long Night. Despairing of the evil that had been unleashed on Earth, the Maiden Maid of Light turned her back upon the world, and the Lion of Night came forth in all his wrath to punish the wickedness of men. How long the darkness endured, no man can say, but all agree It was only when a great warrior, known variously as Herkun the Hero, Azar High, Yintar, Nefarian, and Eldric Shadow Chaser, arose to give courage to the race of men and lead the virtuous into battle with his blazing sword, Lightbringer, that the darkness was put to rout, and light and love return once more to the world. Yet the great empire of the dawn was not reborn, for the restored world was a broken place, where every tribe of men went its own way, fearful of all the others, and war and lust and murder endured even to our present day. Also the men and women of the further east believe. At the citadel of Old Town and other centers of learning in the west, Maesters regard these tales of the great empire and its fall as legend, not history. Yet none doubt that the Yeetish civilization is ancient, mayhap even contemporary with the realms of the Fisher Queens beside the Silver Sea. In Yeeti itself, the priests insist that mankind's first towns and cities arose along the shores of the Jade Sea, and dismiss the rival claims of Sarnor and Gis as the boasts of savages and children. Whatever the truth, Yeeti was beyond question one of the places where men first climbed from the pit of savagery to civilization and literacy. For the wise men of the East had been reading and writing for many thousands of years. Their most ancient records are cherished, almost venerated, but also jealously guarded by their scholars. Such accounts as we have are pieced together from hearsay from travelers and scattered texts that have escaped Yeeti to find their way across the seas to the citadel. To tell the tale of Yeeti is far beyond our scope here, comprising as it does hundreds of emperors and myriad wars and conquests and rebellions. Let it suffice to say that the Golden Empire has known golden ages and dark ages, that it has waxed and waned and waxed again throughout the centuries, that it has weathered floods and droughts and sandstorms and quaking of the earth so violent as to swallow entire cities, that thousands of heroes and cravens and concubines and wizards and scholars have passed across the pages of its histories. Since the further east emerged from the long night and the centuries of chaos that followed, 11 dynasties have held sway over the lands we now call Yeeti. Some lasted no more than a half century, the longest endured for 700 years. Some dynasties gave way to others peacefully, others with blood and steel. On four occasions, the end of a dynasty was followed by a period of anarchy and lawlessness, when warlords and petty kings warred with one another for supremacy. The longest of these interregnums lasted more than a century. Though Yeeti is a vast land, much of it covered by dense forest and sweltering jungles, travel from one end of the empire to the other is swift and safe, for the great web of stone roads built by the eunuch emperors of old have no equal in all the world, save for the dragon roads of the Valerians. The cities of Yeeti are far famed as well, for no other land can boast so many. If Lomas Longstrider can be believed, none of the cities of the West can compare to those of Yeeti in size and splendor. Even their ruins put ours to shame, the Longstrider said, and ruins are everywhere in Yeeti. In his Jade Compendium, Colloquo Votar, the best source available in Westeros on the lands of the Jade Sea, wrote that beneath every Yeetish city, three older cities lie buried. Over the centuries, the capital of the Golden Empire has moved here and there and back again a score of times, as rival warlords contended, and dynasties rose and fell. The Grey Emperors, Indigo Emperors, and Pearl White Emperors rule from Yin on the shores of the Jade Sea, first and most glorious of the Yeetish cities. But the Scarlet Emperors raised up a new city in the hearts of the jungle, and named it Siko, the Glorious. Long fallen and overgrown, its glory lives now only in legend. Whilst the Purple Emperors preferred Ti Kui, the many-towered city in the western hills, and the Maroon Emperors kept their martial court in Jin Ki, the better to guard the frontiers of the empire against the Reavers from the Shadowlands. Today Yin is once more the capital of Yi Ti. There the 17th Azure Emperor, Bu Gai, sits in splendor in a palace larger than all King's Landing. Yet far to the east, well beyond the borders of the Golden Empire proper, past the legendary Mountains of the Morn, in the city of Kerkasa on the Hidden Sea, dwells in exile a sorcerer lord who claims to be the 69th Yellow Emperor, from a dynasty fallen for 1,000 years. And more recently, a general named Po Ko, Hammer of the Jogus Nahai, has given himself imperial honors, naming himself the first of the Orange Emperors, with the rude, sprawling garrison city called Trader Town as his capital. Which of these three emperors will prevail is a question best left to the historians of the years to come. No discussion of Yi Ti would be complete without a mention of the Five Forts, a line of hulking ancient citadels that stand along the far northeastern frontiers of the Golden Empire, between the Bleeding Sea, named for the characteristic hue of its deep waters, supposedly a result of a plant that grows only there, and the Mountains of the Morn. The Five Forts are very old, older than the Golden Empire itself. Some claim they were raised by the Pearl Emperor during the morning of the Great Empire to keep the line of night and his demons from the realms of men. And indeed, there is something godlike or demonic about the monstrous size of the forts, for each of the five is large enough to house 10,000 men, and their massive walls stand almost 1,000 feet high.
Certain scholars from the West have suggested Valyrian involvement in the construction of the five forts, for the great walls are single slabs of fused black stone that resemble certain Valyrian citadels in the West. But this seems unlikely, for the forts predate the Freehold's rise, and there is no record of any dragon lords ever coming so far east. Thus, the five forts must remain a mystery. They still stand today, unmarked by time, guarding the marches of the Golden Empire against raiders out of the Grey Waste.
Of the lands that lie beyond the five forts, we know even less. Legends and lies and travellers' tales are all that ever reach us of these far places. We hear of cities where the men soar like eagles on leathern wings, of towns made of bones, of a race of bloodless men who dwell between the deep valley called the Dry Deep and the mountains. Whispers reach us of the Grey Waste and its cannibal sands, and of the shrikes who live there, half-human creatures with green-scaled skin and venomous bites. Are these truly lizard men, or more likely, men clad in the skins of lizards? Or are they no more than fables, the grumkins and snarks of the eastern deserts? And even the shrikes supposedly live in terror of Kadath in the Grey Waste, a city said to be older than time, where unspeakable rites are performed to slake the hunger of mad gods. Does such a city truly exist? If so, what is its nature? On such matters, even Lomas Lungstrider is silent. Perhaps the priests of Yeti know, but if so, these are not truths they care to share with us.
The God Emperors of Yeti. To recount even the most important events of this long history would require more words than we have. Yet we would be remiss if we did not at least mention a few of the more fabled of the God Emperors of Yeti. Ha Loi, the first of the Grey Emperors, whose throne was said to be a saddle, for he spent his entire reign at war, riding from one battle to another. Chok Chok, the humpbacked 15th and last of the Indigo Emperors, who kept 100 wives and 1,000 concubines, and sired daughters beyond count, but was never able to produce a son. Mengo Quen, the glittering god, third of the jade-green emperors, who ruled from a palace where the floors and walls and columns were covered in gold leaf, and all the furnishings were made of gold, even to the chamber pots. Lotho, called Lo Longspoon and Lo the Terrible, the 22nd Scarlet Emperor, a reputed sorcerer and cannibal, who is said to have supped upon the living brains of his enemies with a long pearl-handled spoon after the tops of their skulls had been removed. Lodok, called Lo Lakwit, the 34th Scarlet Emperor, a seeming simpleton, cursed with an affliction that made him jerk and stagger when he walked, and drool when he tried to speak, who nonetheless ruled wisely for more than 30 years, though some suggest the true ruler was his wife, the formidable Empress Barthi Marlo. The 9 eunuchs, the pearl-white emperors who gave Yeti 130 years of peace and prosperity. As young men and princes, they lived as other men, taking wives and concubines and siring heirs, but upon their ascent each surrendered his manhood root and stem, so that he might devote himself entirely to the empire. Jarha and his sons Jarjok and Jarhan, the 6th, 7th, and 8th of the Sea-Green Emperors, under whose rule the empire reached the apex of its power. Jarha conquered Leng, Jarjok took Great Marag, Jarhan exacted tribute from Karth, Olgis, Ashai, and other far-flung lands, and traded with Valyria. Chiduk, the 4th Yellow Emperor, who took to wife a noblewoman of Valyria and kept a dragon at his court.
The Plains of the Jogus Nahai. North of Yeti, the windswept plains and rolling hills that stretch from the Golden Empire's frontiers to the desolate shores of the Shivering Sea are dominated by a race of mounted warriors called the Jogus Nahai. Like the Dothraki of the Western Grasslands, they are a nomadic people who live their lives in yurts, tents, and saddles, a proud, restless, warlike race who prize their freedoms above all, and are never content to remain in one place for long. Yet in many ways these riders of the further east are very different from the horse lords of the west. The Jogus Nahai are, as a rule, a head shorter than their counterparts, and less comely to western eyes. Squat, bow-legged, and swarthy, with large heads, small faces, and a sallow cast of skin. Men and women both have pointed skulls, a result of their curious custom of binding the heads of their newborn during the first 2 years of life. Where Dothraki warriors pride themselves on the length of their braid, the men of the Jogus Nahai shave their heads but for a single strip of hair down the center of the skull, whilst their women go wholly bald and are said to scrape all the hair from their female parts as well. The mounts of the Jogas Nahai are smaller than the fiery steeds of the Dothraki, for the plains east of the Bones are drier and less fertile than the Dothraki Sea. Their grasses sparser, offering meager sustenance to horses. And so these Easterners ride Zorses, hardy beasts originally made by breeding horses with certain strange horse-like creatures from the southern regions of Yiti and the island of Leng. Foul-tempered beasts, their hides marked with black and white stripes. The Zorses of the Jogas Nahai are renowned for their toughness and can supposedly survive on weeds or devil grass for many turns of the moon and travel long distances without water or fodder. Unlike the Dothraki, whose cows lead huge khalasars across the grasslands, the Jogas Nahai travel in small bands, closely connected by blood. Each band is commanded by a Jat, or war chief, and a moon singer, who combines the roles of priestess, healer, and judge. The Jat leads in war and battle and raid, whilst other matters are ruled by the band's moon singer.
Amongst the Jogas Nahai, Jats are usually men and moon singers women. But female Jats and male moonsingers are not unknown. This is not always obvious to strangers, however, for a girl who chooses the warrior's way is expected to dress and live as a man, whilst a boy who wishes to be a moonsinger must dress and live as a woman.
Dothraki cows make endless war on one another once beyond the sacred precincts of Baez Dothrak, their holy city. But the guards of the Jogas Nahai forbid them to shed the blood of their own people. Young men do ride out to steal goats, dogs, and zorses from other bands, whilst their sisters go forth to abduct husbands. But these are rituals hallowed by the guards of the plains, during which no blood may be shed. The face the Zorse riders show outsiders is very different, however, for they live in a state of perpetual war against all the neighboring peoples. Their attacks upon Nagai, the ancient land to the northeast of their domains, has reduced that once proud kingdom to a single city, Nefer, and its hinterlands. Legend claims that it was the Jogas Nahai, led by the Jatar, the Jat of Jats, and war leader of the whole people, Garrick Squintai, who slew the last of the stone giants of Jogwin at the battle in the Howling Hills. Before the dry times and the coming of the great Sand Sea, the Jogas Nahai fought many a bloody border war against the patrimony of Herkun as well, poisoning rivers and wells, burning towns and cities, and carrying off thousands into slavery on the plains, whilst the Herkun, for their part, were sacrificing tens of thousands of their Zorse riders to their dark and hungry gods. The enmity between the nomads and the warrior women of the Bones runs deep and bitter to this very day, and over the centuries, a dozen Jatars have led armies up the Steel Road. Thus far, all these assaults have broken against the walls of Kaya Kaya Naya. Yet the moon singers still sing of the glorious day to come when the Jogas Nahai shall prevail and spill over the mountains to claim the fertile lands beyond. Even the mighty Golden Empire of Yiti is not exempt from the depredations of the Jogas Nahai. As many a Yitish lord and princeling has learned to his grief, raids and incursions into the empire are a way of life amongst the nomads. The source of the gold and gems that drape the arms and necks of their moon singers and jets, and of the slaves that serve them and their herds. Over the past 2,000 years, the Zorse riders of the northern plains have reduced to ruins a dozen Yeatish cities, 100 towns, and farms and fields beyond counting.